Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And that program is the Indie Week. This week's issue, July the 28th of 2023, is read by John Federson. That's me. And our issue this week has plenty of articles. I don't need to dip in and out of IndieWeek.com very much today, and that's good because I love the rustling of fresh paper here in our studio. So let's get to it. And a cover article is called Game Changers by Jasmine Gallup, and it's about women's soccer in North Carolina and worldwide. Avon Alvarez is only 16, but she already knows where she wants to be in 10 years, playing professional soccer for the U.S. Women's National Team. That's USWNT, like her hero Emily Fox. She's amazing. Alvarez says, I watched her at UNC and was just so impressed with her, not just her soccer ability, but also her character off the field. I really look up to her. Fox is a starting defender for the U.S. team at this year's Women's World Cup, which kicked off July the 20th in New Zealand and Australia. She's one of a dozen or so players on the international stage who honed her game in North Carolina, either at the college level or by playing for the state's professional team, the North Carolina Courage. For Alvarez, a new hope local, it's not hard to imagine going pro. In North Carolina, there's a clear path forward for female soccer players, one that can lead to the highest level of play. Alvarez, like many children in North Carolina, started playing soccer as part of a recreational team that doesn't require tryouts. This is how most people picture local soccer, hot summer day with volunteer coaches and orange slices. It's non-competitive environment where youth can make friends and get exercise. But unlike some of her peers, Alvarez didn't quit after a few years. Instead, she's kept climbing, joining a competitive team at age 10. She knew she wanted to get serious about the game after watching the 2019 Women's World Cup win the U.S. Women's National Team clinch their fourth international championship. It really inspired me, she says. Ever since then, I've had the goal of being able to do that someday, represent my country at full team level. A talented defender in her position as outside back, Alvarez already has a leg up as a member of the Women's National for players under 17. That's where a few current NT players make their start, and she's already being recruited by several top college teams, though she can't talk about the details. In 2019, she was invited to train with the NC Courage, where she got to meet Fox in person and play alongside the pros. She admires Fox's speed and technicality, she says. In practice, she set her own goal of winning the ball in more advanced positions, as well as creating attacking chances and assisting goals. It's a strategy often utilized by defenders on the national team. In the team's first World Cup match on July 21st, Fox and other defenders created some scoring opportunities by winning the ball in midfield or making long passes toward the goal. Assisted by surprising and creative plays, forward Sophia Smith scored 2 goals during her World Cup debut. These kinds of aggressive play by newcomers make the World Cup thrilling to watch. You'll never know who will become the next soccer superstar. The path to going pro often starts with a league like the Triangle's North Carolina Football Club, NCFC. Youth. That's a group for kids aged 2 to 19. Many who play competitively for NCFC go on to have college careers, including Macy Bader, 20, who plays for UNC Charlotte. Bader was serious about soccer from a young age, but playing with NCFC helped her realize her goals. She says, ever since I was little, I knew I wanted to go pro. But specifically, I remember middle school because we weren't allowed to play on our middle school team while playing for NCFC. That didn't really bother me that much because I just wanted to be at the higher level. After graduating from a youth league like NCFC, the next highest level of soccer can be found on college campuses. Fortunately for aspiring pros, North Carolina is home to 17 Division I women's soccer teams, including what is arguably the best women's soccer team in the nation, the UNC Chapel Hill Tar Heels. Over the past four decades, the Heels have won 21 NCAA championships and launched the careers of soccer greats Mia Hamm, who once held the record for most goals scored, Tobin Heath, a two-time World Cup champion, and Crystal Dunn, who's returning to the national team this year as a defender with 24 international goals. Coached by Anson Dorrance since 1979, the UNC team was the first varsity-level women's program in the Southeast. Dorrance has seen many of his college players move on to professional careers, including Hamm, Heath, and Dunn. In 2017, North Carolina secured its own pro team with the NC Courage. That's provided even more opportunities for female soccer players, says Paul Forster, who's NCFC Director of Soccer. And he says, we have these professionals playing on our own back doorstep. These young girls can go and watch every Saturday and say, that's what I want to do. Over the past 10 years, the success of the national team has sparked a growing interest in women's soccer. With that interest comes growing support through higher salaries for professional players and more money going into the National Women's Soccer League. It wasn't easy, though. Professional women's soccer didn't even exist in the U.S. until 2000, when 20 national players fresh off their second world championship organized to start their own league. More than 30 years after the first men's soccer league was founded in the U.S. Despite the players' success on the field, that first league folded after only 3 years. The second attempt in 2007 lasted only 5 years, and it wasn't until 2012 that the NWSL was formed, the first women's pro league to get sustained support, and thanks to the hard work of players like Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan, women's professional soccer is finally taking off. Home to 12 teams, the soccer league is set to add two teams in 2024 and another two in 2026. This year bids to buy the new San Francisco team, dubbed the Bay Football Club, reached a record $53 million, more than 10 times what owners paid for women's soccer league's team just a few years ago. Celebrities as well are throwing their support behind the league by becoming investors. Movie stars like Natalie Portman, Eva Longoria, and Reese Witherspoon all have a stake, as well as renowned female athletes like Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka, who is an investor in the North Carolina Courage. Dorrance says we're at the nexus of an economic revolution for the women's game. He cited a recent instance in which one investor, Michelle Kang, paid $10 million above the asking price for a team, the Washington Spirit. Dorrance says she was indicating not only that her franchise was worth more than the $25 million they were asking for, but also that all of the franchises across the country in the league were worth more. When it comes to player pay, it's the same story. National team players led the charge, filing a legal complaint against the U.S. Soccer Federation in 2016 over unequal pay and treatment. Although the women's national team was generating way more revenue than the men's team, top female players at the time were being paid 5.5 times less than the men. As a woman, winning the World Cup netted you $75,000. Men received a bonus of $390,000. And it wasn't just the pay. National women's players also received less travel compensation, put up in worse hotels, and played on poorer fields. Despite years of lobbying U.S. soccer leaders for better treatment, the women's proposals were rejected over and over again. Then, in 2020, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, another UNC alumna, was named the first female president of U.S. soccer. All of a sudden, things started to change. In 2022, U.S. soccer reached a settlement with the women's players that provided nearly $24 million in back pay and pledged to equalize pay between men and women. Last year, the women's players finally secured a living wage through a collective bargaining agreement, which also instituted long overdue reforms to the league schedule and contract rules. Forster says female players are now in a position where they're getting paid enough to actually live. They're not all millionaires, but there's been so much positive change to support the growth of the female game at all levels. More people are also playing and watching women's soccer. The 2019 Women's World Cup final was the most watched match in the tournament's history, netting an average live audience of 82 million across the globe, 56% more viewers than in the 2015 final. But in the States, women's soccer still needs to attract more fans, says Dorrance. He says, Chapel Hill has always been a leader, but most of our leadership in the early years was just developing great players that win games. Now we also want to be a leader in attendance. If people are paying top dollar to watch women compete athletically, then their salaries are going to improve. I want to be a part of that. Today, there's more excitement than ever around the U.S. women's national team as they head to their ninth World Cup. North Carolinians, in particular, can be proud of the fact that six players from the Courage represent nations from across the globe. Two will be playing for the U.S. Goalkeeper Casey Murphy and defender Emily Fox. To see their evolution has been tremendous, says Courage head coach Sean Nahas. It's a little bit personal for me because I know where they started several years ago. I'm looking for them to go and have a big impact for the States, and hopefully they come back as world champions. Like many other national team players, this will be Fox's first World Cup. She made her first appearance for the Nationals in 2018, went on to play 28 more international matches, and helped the U.S. win the She Believes Cup earlier this year. Nah says of her play, she's sort of a free spirit. She's quiet, but when she plays, her personality comes out. She's great on the ball. She's great at getting forward. She's great in tight spaces. Her ability to get out of trouble, her ability to pass and combine, that's what makes her dangerous at the next level. Nass adds, if she's in a situation where the U.S. asks her to get forward, down, and back, it could be a lot of trouble for the opposition because she's so hard to track. Murphy also has a chance to make her first appearance at the World Cup this year, likely as a substitute for longtime national goalkeeper Alyssa Neher. Although Neher has more experience, Murphy is a rising star. She made her first appearances for the women's team in 2021 when she saved an astonishing 8 goals against Australia. Murphy's time on the Courage, particularly under assistant coach Nathan Thackeray, has been a tremendous help in my growth, she says. What's great about the Courage is that the environment is super intense and is high level. So when I come in with the national team, it's not that big of a jump. She adds, I was pretty clear when I joined the team what my goals were, to be the best goalkeeper in the world. He helps me to keep to that standard. Thackeray, who has coached Murphy for about 3 years, says she's made major progress both on and off the field. Like the player herself, Thackeray credits some of her growth to the competitive environment at the NC Courage. Also crucial, however, is Murphy's personal drive. He says she's relentless in her approach to getting better. She wants to win in everything she does. Without her attitude, her mentality toward being the best, she wouldn't be where she is. All in all, Murphy has played more than 1,000 minutes of international soccer, but this year's World Cup comes with the added challenge of defending the U.S. title and vying for a third consecutive championship, a feat unprecedented among either men or women. Avid fans, including Alvarez, will be watching. She says she always watches the World Cup at home, surrounded by family. She's rooting for the U.S. Quote, "It's the pressure of having the target on our back to win the game and advance in the tournament," says Murphy. "What gives me comfort is knowing everyone's feeling the pressure. It's a matter of how you handle it." The 27-year-old goalkeeper sees the tournament, quote, "as an opportunity to acknowledge that I'm going to feel pressure for the rest of my career, especially playing with the national team." Thackeray says that this will not be Murphy's last World Cup. He hopes to see her shine on the world stage, but he and Murphy both know her role in the lineup is someone else's decision. "I'd love it if she was to start and be the number one, because I think she has that quality. But to be honest," Thackeray says, "I hope she just embraces the moment. She's got a long future in the game." And this being a Thursday, the 17th, I have a little update on the sidebar that the USA national team over at the World Cup tied the Netherlands 1-1, which keeps them unbeaten so far in competition. And the next game, I can't remember when that's going to be, in a few days. So that's it from soccer. All right, Lena Geller offers our next article, Pregnancy Protections. In mid-May, Sierra McLean, a server at First Watch, learned that she was 6 weeks pregnant. She immediately passed the news along to her manager. McLean was working at a Durham location of the national breakfast restaurant chain First Watch, near South Point Mall. Her decision to divulge the pregnancy was driven by a misconception about North Carolina law. She thought that workers were legally obligated to disclose pregnancies to their employers. A less optimistic person might have based that assumption on our legislature's affinity for policing the bodies of its constituents. But McLean, a bubbly Georgia native who tries to see the best in people, envisioned the requirement, which, to be clear, does not exist on state nor federal levels, as a common-sense safety precaution. In the case of emergency, she figured it was imperative that a supervisor be made aware of a worker's pregnancy at the earliest possible date. Indeed, the very next month, McLean did find herself in an emergency situation. At First Watch, she slipped on a pool of water that had accumulated under a ceiling leak and fell hard on her left side, bruising her hip and knee. When she was seen by a doctor that night, she learned that a blood clot had formed around her placenta. McLean is okay now, and her unborn child is not in danger. But her transparency with First Watch, transparency that she'd imagined would help in a situation like slipping on a wet spot, played no role in her recovery. She says, in fact, it ended up making everything worse. 50 years ago, it was not uncommon for pregnant workers to wear girdles and baggy clothes to hide growing stomachs from bosses. In 1978, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, the PDA, made it illegal for any company with 15 or more employees to consider pregnancy status while hiring, firing, and enumerating wages. A shift toward a more equitable reality, seemed possible. But in the decades since, the efficacies of the Act's protection have been overstated, according to Elizabeth Gedmark, vice president of the workers' advocacy group A Better Balance, and co-author of the book Babygate, How to Survive Pregnancy and Parenting in the Workplace. For many low-wage workers, whose labor, Gedmark notes, is often made invisible in our country, the PDA's stated protections have not translated from theory to practice. Specifically, gaps in the law have allowed employers to deny pregnant workers requests for simple temporary accommodations such as water breaks or relief from lifting heavy objects. In some cases, an employer might use a worker's accommodation as an excuse to fire them, arguing they can no longer adequately perform their job. A more surreptitious strategy, though, is to keep a worker on the payroll while continuously rejecting their accommodation requests, effectively forcing them to quit. McLean, who quit her job at First Watch, has become intimately familiar with that approach. First Watch did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. In the weeks after McLean disclosed her pregnancy to the manager, she says her schedule was cut from 5 days to four and then to three. There were also a number of instances where she was told to go home right after clocking in for a shift. She says they would say they had enough people on the floor, even on weekends when we would be packed with customers. Her shift typically started around 7:30 a.m. and lasted 6 or 7 hours. Serving at all is physically taxing. She had to be on her feet the whole time, table hopping, running hot platters of food, and brunch is widely viewed as the worst shift. Customers are crabbier, dishes are more modifiable, and thus more prone to error, and ticket printers run rapid fire. But McLean was happy to throw herself into the fray. For pregnancy accommodations, all she needed was a short mid-shift break to sit down and drink water, which would relieve her nausea, but those break requests were declined, she says. Saying it felt like they wanted to fire me, but they couldn't. They were trying to push me out. Her fall happened in early June. Management told her to go to urgent care, but when she arrived, the facility didn't have an ultrasound machine on hand. She ended up driving to Duke Regional Hospital and spent 10 hours in the emergency room, worrying about the fall's impact on her pregnancy. She returned to work the following weekend for her shift and was told by her manager that the restaurant was sufficiently staffed and she should go home. By that point, her schedule had dwindled to 2 days a week. She already had two kids at home, a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old, and needed to save up for the new baby. First Watch was paying her $2.15 an hour. So 2 days, or roughly 13 hours of work, netted her about $7.60 plus tips. Between the lack of accommodations, the lack of hours, and radio silence from a representative that First Watch told her would reach out about worker compensation, she felt she had no option but to quit and find a different job a few weeks later. McLean's experience was distressing, but hopefully it's about to become a lot rarer. Just weeks after McLean left First Watch on June 27th, a new federal law, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, PWFA, which passed in December, went into effect. This requires most employers to afford a wide breadth of pregnancy accommodations to workers, including accommodations that one might need postpartum. According to Gidmark, the PWFA closes a major loophole in the decades-old PDA. Under the PDA, workers were only legally entitled to a pregnancy accommodation if they could prove that another employee had received the same accommodation in the past, which placed an undue onus on workers and also created a pretty glaring catch-22. Scores of states implemented their own discrimination and accommodation laws in previous years to address this loophole. North Carolina is one of four states with no statewide protections against discrimination, and its accommodation law only applies to state employees. The PWFA shifts the burdens to employers. If a pregnant worker requests an accommodation, employers now must engage in an interactive process to meet their needs, says Gidmark. To reject an accommodation request, an employer would need to prove that said accommodation poses a significant threat to the business, finance, or operations. Since pregnancy accommodations are temporary, this would be quite hard to substantiate. The PWFA also mandates that employers give workers the option of taking unpaid time off to recover from childbirth. This may not sound like a big deal. Paid parental leave, of course, would be ideal, but in a high turnover service industry, it is a game changer for employees. Before the FA was enacted, some workers could take unpaid time off through the Family and Medical Leave Act, which guaranteed that their jobs would be protected during the postpartum recovery period. To qualify for the Family and Medical Leave Act, a worker was required to have spent a year or more with the same employer, which boxed out a large sect of low-wage workers. Now, people like McLean, who just started working a new job at Old Navy, can know their jobs will be waiting for them after the recovery period. While she was not able to reap the benefits of PWFA at First Watch, her requests for accommodations have gone over well at her new job, she says. She's become well-versed in the new legislation since joining the Union of Southern Service Workers. That's a cohort that evolved from the southern branch of the National Workers' Right Movement, Fight for $15 this month. Group members have connected McLean with an attorney in case she decides to follow up on a workers' compensation claim, and on a muggy mid-July day, they also join her to stage a demonstration in front of First Watch. Aisha Francis, a USSW member, after delivering a summary of the new protections, says, "We're out here to let all pregnant women know, to let all people know that you have rights. No more of this discrimination and acting like bringing a life into this world is some kind of crime, because someone brought you into this world, so how dare you?" McLean is next to the microphone. A few seconds after she starts recounting her First Watch experiences, she pauses and says she's nervous. A white scar is still visible on her knee from the fall. "We got your back," the crowd shouts in unison. McLean picks up where she left off. USSW members punctuate each stated instance of mistreatment with a chorus of, "That ain't rights," and her confidence seems to grow over the course of her speech. When she's done, an organizer hands her a printed copy of the PWFA and a roll of tape. "Watch this," someone shouts, and McLean tapes the PWFA to the door of the restaurant, raising her fist. Lena Geller's next column was updated just on Wednesday. At the request of several elected officials, Durham City Attorney Kimberly Rayburg last month asked Wikipedia to unmask the identities of users who have published accurate but unfavorable information about said officials to the crowdsourced encyclopedia, a move that experts call inappropriate and troubling. In a certified letter to the Wikipedia Foundation, dated June 29th and obtained by Indy last week, Rayburg explained that she was writing at the express request of Mayor Elaine O'Neill and City Council members Adriana Freeman and Monique Holsey-Hyman, each of whom took issues with their content on their Wikipedia pages. Rayburg said the three officials wanted the real names of the volunteer contributors Will That Cheerleader 18, Mako 001, and Johnson 524, and asked Wikipedia to permanently prohibit an image of O'Neill's facsimile signature from appearing on the site. O'Neill is not seeking a second term, but for Freeman, who recently announced a mayoral run, and Holsey-Hyman, who was appointed to the council last year and is running to keep her seat, the unmasking requests appear to be a pre-election attempt to clean up web pages that prominently feature allegations of misconduct. O'Neill, Holsey-Hyman, and Freeman did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. Holsey-Hyman is being investigated by the State Bureau of Investigation following a developer's allegation that she attempted to solicit a bribe in exchange for her vote on a rezoning proposal. She has also been accused of improperly attempting to enlist city staff to work on her re-election campaign. Freeman made news in March when her defense of Holcy Hyman during a contentious city council meeting led to a profane shouting match that reportedly turned physical. On Wikipedia, the allegations and shouting match are summarized without any apparent factual error and with links to news articles as references. But Rayburg wrote in the letter that Holcy Hyman, quote, contends the allegations are fabricated and thus seeks to obtain the identity of user Will the Cheerleader 18, who created Holcy Hyman's page and wrote much of its content. Holcy Hyman also requested the identity of user MAKO001, who, quote, insisted on preserving a link to Durham City Councilwoman Jillian Johnson on her page after another user removed it. It's unclear why Holcy Hyman would take issue with Johnson's name being linked on her page, though notably the edited history on the page shows that Mako's revisions involved more than the link reinstatements. On April 2nd, a user called MPink10 made 14 edits to Holcy Hyman's page. MPink10 had not made Wikipedia edits of any kind prior to this day and has not since. The first edit was a deletion of the page's entire extortion allegations and investigations section, which is where Johnson's name is linked. Mako 001 reversed the revision almost immediately, noting that MPIC had removed content without adequately explaining why. 5 minutes later, MPIC deleted the extortion section again, and also the personal life section, which listed the names of Holcy Hyman's husband and daughter. Mako 001 reverted the edit soon after, and MPIC subsequently deleted the extortion section for a third time. When another user, U.S. History Geek, restored that section 2 minutes later, MPink10 stopped trying. Holcy Hyman did not respond to an email from Indy asking if she was user MPink10. Anyone can edit a Wikipedia entry, though to help guard against vandalism, erroneous material, and unjustified content removals, new revisions are listed on an unapproved edits page until they're greenlit or reverted by reputable users like Mako 001. These volunteer editors are fiercely proactive, protective, and push back hard when a single user, MPink10, for instance, makes edits to sanitize a page. With their request, council members appeared to show significant misunderstanding of internet protocol. Freeman, according to Rayburg's letter, viewed Wikipedia's summary of her public defense as Holcy Hyman as unflattering and conveyed deep unease that the same user who created Holcy Hyman's page, that's Will the Cheerleader 18, had created Freeman's own page. It is standard for a single user to pen multiple related entries and make edits across a range of pages. On the day Mako 001 reverted those edits on Holcy Hyman's page, the user also worked on more than 200 other pages, including list of WWE SmackDown Tag Teams Champion, Siege video game, and Norse mythology. Will the Cheerleader 18, who created the page, also created the Wikipedia for Johnson and City Council member Javier Caballero. The person behind Will the Cheerleader 18, a Raleigh resident who asked the Indy not to reveal her name, says she's crafted more than 1,000 Wikipedia pages, mostly about women in leadership positions. She's part of a Wikipedia initiative called Women in Red that aims to reduce gender bias on the platform. She says that's kind of terrifying when she's told about the city's request that Wikipedia unmask her identity. Nothing that's in their articles is unsourced. It's all based off of news stories, which is where you get your cited information. I do find it interesting that they're not going after news sources for reporting those stories. Wikipedia is just an encyclopedia that gathers public information. While both city council members were focused on their wiki page's portrayal of certain reported events, O'Neill was concentrated on an image of her signature. Writing on the mayor's behalf, Rayburg asked Wikimedia to identify user Johnson524, who had uploaded the signature image. O'Neill found it, quote, problematic for her personally and professionally, wrote Rayburg. Under state law, this facsimile signature is not a public record, says Brooks Fuller, the director of the North Carolina Open Government Coalition at Elon University. But while it's illegal to use her signature inappropriately, there's nothing illegal about posting an image of it on Wikipedia. The city had no legal basis to ask to take it down, especially because O'Neill already knew where the image came from. After discovering the signature, the city opened an internal investigation into its origin. The five people with authorized access to the facsimile signature denied uploading it. So in late June, Rayburg became user Kimlin69 and reached out to Johnson524 through Wikipedia's talk feature. I am the city attorney for the city of Durham, North Carolina. Mayor Elaine O'Neill's city staff recently noted that an image of her signature had been added to her Wikipedia page, which raised concern about the presence of the unauthorized signature on the page, increasing the likelihood of signature fraud, Rayburg told him. O'Neill, quote, requested that the city attorney's office reach out to legal counsel at Wikimedia Foundation to ask they disclose the identity of the party who uploaded the signature image. Johnson, 524, who tells Indy he's a 17-year-old Johnston County High School student, responded apologetically, telling Rayburg he was terribly ashamed of his actions and explained he'd been taking a photo of O'Neill's signature that appeared at the bottom of her boilerplate welcome letter in playbills at the Durham Performing Arts Center. After reading the mayor's very kind message and seeing her signature, I thought it could also make a good addition to the encyclopedia, he wrote. That was good enough for Rayburg. In light of the information and assurances that user Johnson524 provided, I'm going to hold off on reaching out to Wiki legal counsel for now, Rayburg told O'Neill in an email chain obtained by Indy. Given the terms of service for Wiki and the fact that user obtained the information from materials that are widely disseminated to the public, there is little legal basis to demand that Wiki reveal the identity of the user or prohibit the upload of a photo of that signature to the mayor's Wiki page. Less than an hour later, O'Neill responded, our request still stands, and it is a specific request. That evening, Rayburg replied that the deed was done. Fuller says Rayburg should not have sent the letter, especially the parts pertaining to Freeman and Hoisey Hyman. As a city attorney, she represents the city, not individual politicians. If they believed their Wikipedia pages were defamatory, they're welcome to hire their own attorneys and file a lawsuit. In a phone call Friday afternoon, Rayburg told Indy she has been through a lot this year with the city council, and her decision to send the letter via the postal system only came after great consideration. Ultimately, she determined that the electeds were making requests in their official capacities. And she said, the scope of my duties do extend to representation of elected officials in their official capacities. I don't expect that Wikipedia will pay one mind to that letter, and there won't be any next steps from my office because I don't have authorization from the city council to pursue this as a legal matter. In a July 25th email, a spokesperson for Wikimedia Foundation told Indy it, quote, has not received any requests from the city of Durham, and noted the address at the top of Rayburg's letter is not a current foundation address. For general inquiries, the foundation's postal address is 1 Montgomery Street, Suite 1600 in San Francisco, California. Though for legal requests to disclose user information, it lists a different address in Glendale, California. Rayburg addressed that letter to 140 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. The spokesperson also wrote, Wikimedia Foundation is strongly committed to protecting the privacy of editors and users on Wikimedia projects. As part of our commitments, we intentionally collect very little data about our users, and the data we collect is deleted, aggregated, or anonymized after 90 days. Requests for non-public user data require a valid legal process and are carefully reviewed under the Foundation's standards for privacy and freedom of expression. The spokesperson wrote, when we do receive a legally valid request, we often work with the requester to narrow the parameters of the information sought. And because we keep very little data, we also don't have data to provide in the first place. Even if Rayburg had sent the letter to the right address, it seems there wasn't any chance that Wikimedia would have produced those identities of Will the Cheerleader 18, Mako 101, and Johnson 524. Still, the request has a cost. Enrique Armijo is a professor at Elon School of Law who specializes in First Amendment issues, and he said, it's not a good look for public officials to be expending public resources, tax dollars, and the city attorney's time to try to identify people who publish factual information they don't like. Never mind the whole long-standing First Amendment interest in protecting the anonymity of people who criticize public officials, he adds, it's just not what we want to be doing. Now, next would ordinarily come a long article, but I don't think I have time to read the entire thing. I'm going to put it in my folder and look at it again next week. It's called Dead in the Water, and it's about a Greenway controversy through Bolin Forest. That's in Orange County. And talk of a Greenway has been bitterly divisive for over a decade. And Cy Neff has written that article, and I'm not casting it into the circular file at all, but I have too many other articles that are shorter to get to today. And they're all July album reviews, as it happens. First, this review by Keisha Jennings, Charlie Smarts, and DJ 111 Digits, or I-11 Digits. A recording called Charlie Tape, and it's by Mecca Records, and it was released on April 28th. It's given 4.5 stars, which is pretty high. For the past 15 years, the indie rap group Cooley High has earned a following as one of Raleigh's favorite rap groups, captivating audiences with their boom-bap sound and undeniable collective talent as MC and producers. Whenever one of the group's MCs drops a solo project, fans eagerly anticipate and embrace the continuation of Cooley High's legacy. Out this spring, from Charlie Smarts and DJ I-11 Digits, Charlie Tape, the pair's first release as a duo, is a captivating journey that pays homage to a mixtape culture. The album artfully blends vintage elements with modern sensibilities, and making it a fitting tribute to this year's 50th anniversary of hip-hop. From the opening skit, Charlie Tape intro, the album outlines specific expectations for its listeners. A robot-like voice intones, you are now about to begin a great adventure, a journey out of your mind. Charlie Tape goes on to seamlessly blend all the expected aesthetics of a mixtape, including shout-outs. Produced by a melange of talented producers, including the legendary Ninth Wonder, members of the Soul Council, and in-house Cooley High producers Synopsis and Foolery, the album brings forth a soulful, nostalgic vibe, immediately drawing listeners into an immersive experience of hip-hop's boom-bap heyday in the 90s. The production works as a time machine, taking listeners on a journey through hip-hop's golden era while still sounding fresh and relevant. Each track carefully complements Charlie Smart's prowess on the mic, and his cadence is a highlight of the album. Charlie's confident, smooth delivery showcases his experience as an MC as he effortlessly rides each beat. He's obviously comfortable on the mic, commanding attention with his lyrical finesse and passionate storytelling. The 19-track list is a perfect gift for Coolie High superfans and those who appreciate genuine hip-hop artistry. Each song, from the introspective Hater Anonymous to the uplifting Air Max 95, feels purposeful and adds to the album's cohesive shape. The skits also add an extra layer of depth. The well-placed interludes elevate the album's concept by bridging the gaps between tracks and giving listeners a more profound insight into how music was experienced during the mixtape era. Charlie Smarts and DJ Ill Digits are the only two members of Coolie High to live out of state. Both are now in New York City, but they returned to Raleigh in mid-July for the album's hometown release show, and Charlie Tape succeeds as a testament to North Carolina's vibrant hip-hop scene. Alongside his legendary producers, Charlie Smart embraces the legacy of classic hip-hop while adding in his unique voice, leaving a lasting impact on listeners and proving that quality hip-hop emerges from this region. All in all, Charlie Tape is a soul-stirring journey that showcases the remarkable talent of Charlie Smart as an MC, DJ Ill Digits as a DJ, and the exceptional production skills of the talented producers, whose innovative soundscapes brought depth and dimension to this project. Whether you're a fan of boom bap or a lover of quality hip-hop, this album deserves a spot on your playlist or your cassette player, writes Keisha Jennings, 4.5 stars. Next, Jordan Lawrence's recognition of Goner by Jenny Bissetzt. 4 stars. Goner feels like an album that could have blown up for Jenny Bissetzt several years ago. It still could, mind you. The Raleigh band's best album yet, Goner is an alternately swirling and pounding vision of 80s indebted dream pop that's dark but engaging, pessimistic about relationships and the state of the world, but still clinging to shreds of hope, a struggle that is very real. That Goner's particular brand of nostalgia sounds a bit dated only enhances these themes. The vision it conjures of future islands dance memes and passion pit festival dominance inject a sharp tug from the passage of time. The tropes it tweaks are well-trod, apt reflections of the compulsion to look backward when confronted with harsh realities like the ones leader John Wallaber tackles in the lyrics. One unforgiving reality that hangs over the 7-year gap between Goner and Jenny Bissett's last album, Tender Madness, The Pandemic. This makes the band's continued and impressive honing of a sound that peaked in the 2010s, before the world got put on pause, both hard to criticize and intensely relatable. It's 2023, but in one way or several, we're all picking up where we left off at the close of the previous decade, so perhaps it's the perfect time for Jenny Bissett's to show back up, sounding largely the same, yes, but also better than they ever have. Wallaber's growth as a singer is especially impressive. His frequently deployed low-register affect could come off as a bit forced. Now, his expressive oscillations between that artifice and a softer, more sonorous delivery highlight the record's emotional ups and downs. A shimmery guitar and keys and muscular bass and drums fuse into a propulsive force on that title track. Wallaber laments, "Everyone feels like Goner tonight." turning to the example of Jonathan Brandis, the young star of 90s TV shows like Sequest DSV, who killed himself at 27. The singer murmurs Brandis' name before booming out, "Where are you? Are you still lost at sea?" Alarmed at the prospect of being pulled into a similarly dark place. The musical strides made by the band pushed the album's emotional catharsis even further. The slow build on Abridged Dream, from percolating dark wave to deaf heaven-worthy fury, is a perfect delivery system for Wallaber's escalating consternation as the feeling of disintegration, life folds in at the corners and forgets us, grinded into dust, modern men, children of industry. And the music is just as apt during the album's restrained moments. On the opener, Blonde and Blue, reverberating drum hits and warm guitar conjure echoing, steamy vistas that expertly gird a multi-tracked chorus of Wallaber's divergent vocals as cotton candy skies get tinged with regret, the sun going down on the trailer park, and the narrator thumbing down the edges of letters from you in the county jail. Does Jenny Bisset's sound still line up with current trends? Perhaps not, but Goner doesn't suffer for it. Jordan Lawrence gives that release 4 stars. And finally, from the music section, Brian Howe gives 4 stars to a release made July 7th by Entre Vous. You could run out of fingers and toes trying to count all the Chapel Hill area bands that Clark Albert Blomquist has been in since 1998, let alone the number of genres that they touch. The Baroque Indie of the Kingsbury Manx, the Whispery Folk of Work Clothes, the Odd Pop of Woe Miss, the Garage Rock of Spider Bags, the Punk Rock of Cold Cream, the Experimental Electronics of Tegucigalpan, and his more recent turn to country. Among these, Blomquist has played everything in the standard rock kit and much beyond it. Kelly Reidy has also been writing music and playing shows for 2 decades, though more often as a solo singer-songwriter and in the Triangle only since the pandemic. Her songs provide most of the source material for the debut album by Entre Vous, her new band with Blomquist, who splashes them with the psychedelic watercolors that permeate his most personal projects. Even on a quick impression, the band's concept and styling are striking, and quick impressions are what Entre Vous is all about. Most of the songs are just a minute or two long. They state an atmospheric vision, lodge an earworm, and duck out. They're like interesting confections, brightly colored, but with flavors of umami. We hear blissed out, fuzz-coated country, rock and indie pop with all the sharp interlocking edges that make up a song rounded off, smeared into glowing blurs. Reidy plays melodiously snarling guitar, as well as cello, flute, and synths. Blomquist plays bass, organ, drums, synths, some guitar and cello, and a vibraslap. The record deftly threads between pop immediacy and experimental breadth, and it says something of its boldness that it does not evenly distribute these properties. After all the vocal-led songs, the final third of the record slips into hallucinating instrumental territory that has gleamed on the horizons throughout, where sunburst colors play against shades of gray. The shift marks a practical divide. After most of the record was recorded at Nightlight, the instrumentals were cut and pasted together from a later home session. But the way they run together fits this knowing retropastiche of the naive rock of the Shags, the do-it-yourself twee of K Records, and the trippy frills of Elephant Six. Brian Howe offering 4 stars for Entre Vous, which is also the title of the release. No time for this last music article. also by Brian Howe, called The Ghost of Carborough. It's a two-pager, and I'm running out of time, but I'll give you the zip of it. And let's see. It says 26 years and several zip codes away from where they left off. Local rock heroes, The Pipe, come home with a scorching new album and a lament for affordable living, Brian Howe writes. And the intro says, if you've haunted Carborough since before they cleaned up the telephone poles to match the higher rents, there's a certain visual style you probably associate with local concert flyers. It's colorful, bold, with high-impact text, slicing a strong central graphic into layered planes. Punk, but polished, like Raymond Pettibone meets Andy Warhol. This style emerged in the early 1990s when Ron Liberti started screen printing posters for Cat's Cradle shows. There's something similarly enduring, almost load-bearing, about Liberti as a musician and a scenester, especially with his band, Pipe, which is releasing a new self-titled album via Indianapolis's Third Uncle Records, and that release coming on August the 4th. It might give the wrong impression to call them indie rock, though they are indie, and they do rock. They played loud, swinging, sneakily catchy songs that sounds like they hurt to sing. The riffs stewed in 70s garage and pre-hardcore punk. And this is about a Pipe record release show, which is scheduled for the Cat's Cradle back room in Carborough on August 4th, 9 p.m., admission to which is listed here in Indie Week at $10 to $12. Pipe record release show. The music creeps up behind me. I have to close off today's Indie Week, John Feddersen, with you. And we'll be back next week. I have a couple of unread articles. And the last one in the print edition is about an Akami Sushi bar, which was written by Lena Geller again. And it's about Bird Owatragul, who has a sushi bar inside a gas station space in Apex, North Carolina. And he's winning big fans for this small dining experience. And there's a two-page review of the sushi bar. But that's all I have a chance to read to you about it, just to tell you what it is. And if I'll save it. If we're short next week, we'll get to it. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, John Feddersen says, thank you for listening to Indie Week. And you can visit and see all these stories, if you want, in their entirety on indieweek.com. So long.